Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And today I have another wonderful guest on the podcast, and I'd like to welcome Sarah Swenson. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Mona. It's a pleasure to be here. I am a licensed mental health counselor, licensed in the state of Washington, and I have an international coaching practice, so I'm fortunate to be able to work with couples all around the world. The reason I'm doing this work, it's actually kind of interesting. When I started my private practice, as most therapists do, we decide what is it that I know and where do I think I can be the most helpful. So with my background, I'm a member of Mensa, and I thought, well, I'm in the South Lake Union area of Seattle, where there's all the big tech companies. I knew there was a lot of highly intelligent employees in that area. And so that's what I started with. I started working with highly intelligent individuals. And what happened over time, and it didn't take very long, was that the individuals who came into my practice wanted to talk about their relationships. Mm. And then we discovered they wanted to bring their partners in, their intimate partners in for couple work. And once we began to do that, it became clear to me that what I was thinking about my individual clients was actually true, and that most of them were autistic without a diagnosis, and mm-hmm. their relationships were neurodiverse. So there's a specialist whom I have high regard for. She's a psychologist in Great Britain. Her name is Maxine Aston. And it is her position that in order to understand the dynamics in a neurodiverse couple, a clinician really needs to have personal experience as well as clinical training in the idea of being autistic and what it is to be neurotypical. So I do have that experience, and it felt like a comfortable move for me to go into this amazingly underserved population, which is the neurodiverse couples. So that's how I began. And this was many years ago in Seattle.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that story. And I have to give a shout out to Maxine, because I've had an opportunity to get to know her over the last few years. And I always call her the mother of neurodiverse relationships, because she was working with neurodiverse couples and writing books about mm-hmm. that. Really before anybody else. And if you have not read any of Maxine Aston's book, it's Aston. I would highly recommend that the listeners get all her books, because they are fabulous, fabulous. So Sarah, I have never had anybody on the podcast who shared that they were Mensa. And it's funny, because my daughter and her girlfriend are both Mensa. Uh-huh. And we've had conversations about her girlfriend's IQ is higher than my mm-hmm. daughter's, and so we joke about that. But I think the fact that you chose to work with highly intelligent individuals because of your own, you know, how your own brain is wired, I think is just fantastic. And the area that you were in when you started your practice working with highly mm-hmm. intelligent individuals is an area where there are so many autistic folks who will never be diagnosed. And some of them may really be struggling in their intimate relationships and not understand why. So when they go to a therapist who has no knowledge of autism or neurodiversity, the therapist can actually cause more harm than good. And that had been my experience and many other people's experience. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, Mona, I hear that all the time. And I always this is really something, when couples come to me, I hear things like, this is the last time we're going to try this. Or I don't know what makes us want to try this again. Because so many couples and individuals have really painful stories of working with talented, intelligent therapists who simply don't know neurodiversity when they see it. Yeah. And they therefore conceptualize these couples incorrectly. And the kind of information they provide that's geared in good faith toward helping them resolve their problems just doesn't land, because when there's a neurodiverse couple, one of the great challenges for the autistic partner reside in the very models we use for neurodiverse couples, which is that we have a way of working with couples that is insight based. Like, what is it like for you? And emotion focused. What does it feel like when this happens or when you do that? Well, those two areas are areas of great challenge for the autistic partner, especially on the spot, because of the processing speed differences in these two brains. Mm-hmm. So in the counseling session, if a therapist is not aware of that, the autistic partner looks non-compliant, yep, disinterested, judgmental, and the neurotypical partner looks as if she's claiming a victim role that doesn't appear on the surface to be warranted. She can appear to be hypercritical, which is simply not the case. She's just trying to make her point. And so it's really misconceptualized. Often the couple's misconceptualized right from the beginning. And, yeah, and sometimes they get actually false diagnoses. Neurotypical partner comes away with a speculative diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, narcissism. I mean, I've heard so many really unfortunate things that therapists have suggested, that maybe they describe the behavior, but they don't take into account the intention behind the behavior.
Oh my gosh, Sarah, you have touched on something that is going to be life-changing for the listeners. So I want to unpack it and I want to go deep with this, because when you are diagnosed with something that is incorrect and maybe even given medication, whether you're the autistic partner or the neurotypical holistic partner, it can change your life in ways that are unimaginable in the negative. And then when you realize that you're a neurodiverse couple and one partner is autistic and the other partner might be ADHD or have some other type of neurodivergence, then with the right therapist or coach, you can begin to understand all the things that caused conflict and judgment and resentment and anger and all of that. So I would love for you to share with the listeners, based on your years of experience, what are some of the common challenges that couples are coming to see you about? And you may be their last stop before divorce or ending the relationship. Some of those common challenges that come up that they don't seem to be able to resolve.
Well, yeah, that there's a few things that come up practically every time. So let's start with those.
Okay.
One is that the couple, in generally speaking, it is the, not always, but generally, it is the neurotypical partner who contacts me, mm-hmm, and who has read something I've written or has been talking to somebody and tells me that what I've written is it resonates with their life and they don't know where to go now and what can we do? And the first thing they say is, we just can't communicate. Mm-hmm. We've been together for 30, 20 years, 50 years even, and we just can't, it's like we're from two different planets. That's the first thing I hear. The second thing I hear from the autistic partner, the person I suspect to be autistic, is if only she weren't so angry all the time,
mm-hmm,
right? If she just would just lighten up, slow down, enjoy things, stop criticizing me and not be so angry all the time. What can I do? And on the holistic side, on the neurotypical side, the person says, I am so lonely and I can't get him to understand what I mean when I say that.
Yep.
Because when I say I'm lonely, he says, well, you're never alone. How can you possibly be lonely?
Right.
So those are the two things that come up practically in for every couple. And then there are permutations of those things that show up. A lot of family challenges, extended family challenges. How do we talk about this? Why? What do I do when he leaves the Christmas dinner and goes upstairs without saying anything? That kind of, you know, very, it's a specific kind of problem, but it's surprisingly common.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to people who don't understand why that person would do that. It looks rude, but it's right. Not intended to be rude. So those are the two main buckets, I would say. The challenge of the three, rather, the why is she so angry? I'm lonely and we can't communicate.
And Sarah, I really feel like, you know, you were a fly on the wall of my 30-year marriage. And you basically said, you know, now that I am divorced, you know, it's been 5 years and I've had an opportunity to talk to so many amazing people on the podcast and through the groups that I run, I realize that these are very common themes. And when you come to a therapist who has no experience in neurodiversity, they are absolutely going to use very different techniques mm-hmm. and methods and strategies for dealing with these things. So let's start with the, we can't communicate and I feel so lonely. And what I'd love to do is I'd love to talk about maybe a strategy or two that you share with the couples to help them understand how to communicate mm-hmm. and how to reduce the loneliness. Can you share maybe one thing that you do to help them in those areas?
Sure. The first thing that we do, though, when we begin our work, is make it very clear, and my hope is that couples understand this, that some things can change, and mm-hmm. that's why we're here. But some things can't change.
Yep.
And those things also need to be acknowledged, accommodated, and respected. And the frustration that has accompanied those unchangeable things in the past, that has to be let go. So there's some techniques, et cetera, that align with that part. But that's a little bit down the road with the couple work when we get to that, because our primary focus on the beginning, of course, is, well, what can we do to make this work? Mm-hmm. What can we change? Where's the wiggle room here? And which gaps can be bridged?
Right.
Well, and before we do that, we have to step back a little bit, because it's imperative to me that each couple understand, I mean, each partner in the couple understand his or her own place. So it's important for the autistic person to understand that there is an autistic way of receiving information in the world and of responding to it. And there's also a neurotypical way of receiving information in the world and responding to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're different. They're very different. So it's not only important for the individuals to understand their own way, but it's important for each partner to understand their partners and then to see, well, what are the differences? Yeah. So a lot of the work that I do with couples is really just at the front, is just setting the foundation for what you're asking, which is, well, what can we do then to make some changes that will help us both feel have a better chance of feeling heard or seen, which is what most couples mean when they're talking about neurodiverse challenges with communication.
Yeah, Sarah, you know, again, I've talked to so many people on the podcast and I love the different perspectives, because I think one of the most difficult thing for couples who've been in this dance for a really long time, and, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't find out till we were married 29 years. And at that point we were already separated for almost 2 years. And I think that understanding that some things can change and some things will never change. And I know John and Julie Gottman talk about perpetual problems versus solvable problems. And based on their research, they say that 69% of the problems that couples deal with are perpetual problems. And I really wonder if it's even a higher percentage for neurodiverse couples. And when both partners can understand that there are some things that will never change, then that's information and data that we can use to determine if the relationship is still the right relationship for mm-hmm. us, right? And that goes for both partners. So I think starting from that place and understanding that, you know, I had hoped that all these things would change, mm-hmm. but there were so many things that were never going to change in my ex, and there were so many things that were never going to change in me. And when we understood that, I think we realized that, you know, we needed to part ways, but that's not the case for every couple. So that is really important for people to hear. So I kind of needed to repeat that. And then you said something else, being respectful of the differences and knowing when and where you can accommodate. And I think that's another thing that sometimes one partner or even both partners end up doing for many years. They end up accommodating each other and then they don't even know who they are anymore.
Well, that kind of accommodation is slightly different from what I'm talking about. When I used that word a minute ago, what I meant at that point was, I understand this about my partner, I understand it's part of my partner's way of being in the world. I respect that difference and I will accommodate it to the extent that I can.
Yeah.
In other words, I'll take it into account. What you're talking about is a kind of accommodation that it derives more from a defensive posture of, I can't take any more incoming, so I'm going to make a wall here. I'm going to make a wall here. I'm going to make a wall here. And that's how you lose touch with being who you are, because you're no longer participating in your relationship, because you've got so many barriers that you've set up protectively to keep yourself from getting hurt.
Yes.
You get very isolated, and that is not a place to be. That's a place where it feels as if any kind of couple work might be hopeless.
Yeah. And I think, thank you so much for providing some clarity there, because I think both things can happen kind of at the same time, you know, and whether it's codependency or it's a trauma bond or it's truly not understanding your neurological differences for so long. I mean, we're not going to be able to unpack that, but mm-hmm. I think those are all important things for couples to either think about or explore with their therapist or coach. And so I think you kind of took us back to where you start with couples and how important it is to start with a foundation that will help you at least begin the conversation about what is possible moving, you know, through therapy and counseling or coaching. So mm-hmm. when the couple can't seem to communicate, they are on different planets, not just different pages or in different books, they're on different mm-hmm. planets. What is maybe one thing that you do, a strategy, a technique, or a tool, or even a conversation that you have around mm-hmm. that?
So, right. Yeah, well, one of the first things we do with that particular point is talk about the weight of history and its predictive value. When you have a long-term relationship and you have a consistent, repetitive challenge that comes up over and over and over again, you get to the point where you think, this always happens, what's the point?
Yeah.
And once you get to that point, and if that's still what you're thinking, and you come into couple work, and I talk to you about being mindful of this particular difference, and let's try let's try this example of doing this instead. That weight of history is still sitting there on the couple's shoulders, and they're going to say, "It never works. Okay, didn't work this time either. We tried it, didn't work." Well, so So we have to go back again to a foundational point, which is history doesn't have to be predictive. History is history.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about habits, which is what we're talking about, it's a habit that you expect things to go a certain way because they always have.
Right.
It's a mental habit. Well, we're talking about the psychology of breaking a habit and beginning a new one. And if you've read any of the books about what do you do when you're trying to break a habit or how are you trying to learn a new habit, it takes time of doing something over and over again until you get even that muscle memory, that mental memory that, oh, this is how I do it now.
Yes.
So mindfulness, that weight is sitting there and it's likely to have a pretty big mouth. It's pretty loud.
Yes.
It takes mindfulness to set that aside and say consciously, and this is what, to answer your question, first of all, remember that that is sitting there and it's guiding your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So look at it, tell it, it's probably right about what's always happened before, and thank you. Right? Because we're really, if you just think about your body, you're turning from one direction to another direction. Now you're looking in another direction. That's what a new habit is asking of you.
Right.
And it's this is where I actually bring in the notion of the Zen beginner mind, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have anything being possible. You can change anything. You can affect anything. As long as you're not tied to this other weight. So that we spent a lot of time with that and just creating the space for the new habit to develop.
I love that, Sarah. And no one has described that transition, that pattern shifting, that changing of literally the way in which you function in your relationship so succinctly and in a way that I think is truly going to be a game changer for a lot of couples. So I really think that if both partners see this as literally we are changing a habit in the mm-hmm. way we communicate, because the way my ex and I communicated was my colleague Bron Wilson talks about the communication roundabout. We were having the same arguments, the mm-hmm. same conversations, the same fights, the same disagreements over and over again for 32 years. And we were coming from very different places. And that can lead to the loneliness and the resentment and what you talked about at the beginning with the autistic partner wondering why my partner is always so mad and angry, because you're just stuck in that old pattern of how you communicate. And so you need to shift your brain. You need to rewire. And we all can do it, but it's a choice. Sarah. I mean, yeah. I believe it's a choice, right? You do too? Okay.
Oh, it's a choice. It's also a commitment.
Yes.
And it's also an understanding of the frailty of our best attempts.
Oof.
You know, takes two or three or four attempts to maybe get it right once or twice, right?
Yeah.
And you have to have some grace. You have to extend some grace to yourself that you're fallible, to your partner that you're fallible, and make the commitment to each other that you're acting in good faith. That you're making the attempt to align with this goal you've shared of this new habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where the intention versus the impact is so critical. Mm-hmm. And I hear this over and over in the neurotypical holistic support group that I run. You know, one of the things that we were talking about during this week's group was the tone of voice. Mm-hmm. of the autistic partner and how that continuously triggers some anger or some resentment or something in the neurotypical holistic partner. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, maybe that is a wound you have. If your partner's intent is just to answer your question, but it's impacting you in a really negative way, and that is not their intent, is there some healing that you need to go through? Because that's the way they communicate and it may never change. You know, they're blunt or they're more black and white than you are. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about, you know, how the intention versus the impact also contributes to either good communication or challenging communication.
I have a whole lot of thoughts on that.
Awesome. Awesome.
We spend a great deal of work on that. That's what, when we finally start getting the basics down and we're starting with the same language and moving into the actual work, this is where we start. And what's really important now, we'll talk about the autistic side for just a moment here, but what's really important to understand is that one of the aspects of being autistic is the tendency for singular focus, right? Mm-hmm. For one thing at a time, one focal point at a time. It's a myth that we can multitask. That's another topic. But in right. autism, it's pretty right. specifically one thing at a time. What happens if your partner is trying to listen to what you're saying? Oftentimes you'll see, well, all of a sudden the eye contact falls off. And then you get this answer that comes back and the tone is hitting you the way you just described. Well, another thing that I hear, and you probably hear this too, is that his facial expression doesn't align with what he's saying.
Right.
Yes. Right. Well, that's because of that feature, that single focus feature where everything else falls offline. There's no intent behind the facial expression. There's no intent behind the tone that's so painful. The content of the literal meaning of the words is the focus at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's important for the neurotypical partner to understand, that all these other things that really reside in that 70% or so of communication that's nonverbal,
she's
reading that as we do, but she's also misinterpreting it.
Yes.
Right. So that's a big problem, isn't it? That's where the intent versus meaning, et cetera, gets so muddled. She's reading the way he's communicating as if it were herself communicating that way. And of course, if her tone is abrasive, it's because she's consciously putting spin on it.
Right.
It's no accident if she does it. Right. And I use he and she because our language is so unforgiving. So pardon me for the gender bias. It is not. I work with gay and poly and straight couples around the world. But our English language is not very forgiving on this.
Right.
So
right. I appreciate that. Okay. So again, just reiterating how valuable this is going to be, because when we look at it as our partner who is autistic has a single focus and they're not seeing their tone of voice or hearing their tone of voice the way we are, and their intention is truly to communicate clearly and concisely, not to piss us off, mm-hmm. not to judge us, not to get angry, that it's literally the most important thing we can do is listen to the words.
And I agree.
Right. And not look at all the other things through our narrative, through our story, through how we would want that information to be communicated with a different type of emotion, a different type of facial expression. Again, gosh, Sarah, if I had known all this at the beginning of my marriage, the amount of conflict that we would have avoided is just monumental for both of us, right?
Yeah.
So that is very critical. And then I'd like to switch over to the autistic person who comes in and is meeting with you and says, why is she so mad? Why is she so angry? Why do our conversations always go off the rail when I'm just trying to tell her what I'm thinking or experiencing? Let's talk a little bit about where the disconnect is there and what you might do to reframe that so the couple understands where that's going off the rail. Okay, so one of the things that you said is that a lot of couples, when they come in, the autistic partner is asking, why is my partner so mad, so angry, and why can't they just, you know, take things, have a little lighter attitude? And I'll tell you, my ex-husband used to say that all the time. In fact, one of the things he used to say, Sarah, is, I like you so much better when you have had one drink.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I hear that a lot. I hear that a lot. Yeah.
So what is the shift or the understanding that needs to take place, and how do you help couples with that shift or understanding so that that isn't the case? Because it's a whole different way of looking at communication and conversation through, again, the autistic lens.
Absolutely, it is. And as I mentioned a minute ago, what we first get the things clarified about the nonverbal aspect of communication that throws spin on the literal meaning of the words. But then then I always use this, I'm sure you've seen them and probably many of your listeners have too. There are many versions of this wheel that's the language of emotion. And it starts in the center with some fairly umbrella-like terms like angry, happy, sad, and I think there's five of them in the middle, and then they move out in concentric circles that are become more nuanced and then ever more nuanced. What happens is that generally the autistic partner uses those five central words repetitively and actually perceives emotions in terms of those five basic words. Whereas the neurotypical partner has a tendency to go out maybe the second, even the third, even beyond that, with being able to nuance. So instead of angry, what she's perceiving, what she's expressing, is frustration or maybe impatience or anything that's just a slight annoyance, right? It can be any grade of discomfort. But he's going to read that as angry. And then he's going to assume that her posture is anger, and therefore everything that she says is an angry thing she's saying. So he's going to feel then also a great deal of the time that that anger coming at him has something to do with him, something he did. So it's not just why is she always so angry, but why is she always so angry at me? Right, which is a twofer because she's not angry and it has nothing to do with you. And that's one of the ways that things go off the rails right away, because he's going to be defensive. She's saying how frustrated she is because the mail was late and she was waiting for something, and he's thinking, "Oh God, what do I do now?" He's going to get defensive, and no matter what, he's going to say something that's not going to align with what she needs by virtue of what she's trying to talk about.
Oh my gosh.
She's going to feel not heard and he's going to get angry. And before you know it, they're at cross purposes and it can really get out of hand before they're not even talking about the same thing.
That again, 30 years of my marriage. And I want to say, because I've talked about this a lot of times, we can love our partners. I mean, I loved my husband the entire time we were married. Love had nothing to do with it. And, you know, couples who I've talked to and gotten to know over the years, they're like, I love him or her or them. They are such kind, nice people. And, you know, they can list 25 good things about the relationship and their partner, but there's this major disconnect. And what you said, again, is so important, because I just have this vision in my head of all the conversations and conflicts that I got into with my ex-husband, and he would say to me, I will never be able to meet your expectations. I am always wrong. It's my fault. And I would say, no, I didn't say that. Those words were not ever in my mouth. I never said that. But now, you know, and you're explaining it in a much better way than maybe I have ever had somebody explain it. It's because there's a difference in the nuance of the emotions that we maybe understand and feel. So how does the autistic person stop that habit of seeing their partner being mad at them or blaming them or angry, because that's not the intent.
Well, that this is an example of where we bring in that mantra of the Zen beginner mind again. This is a good juncture for that, where history is history. It's not necessarily predictive. So that we bring that into a lot of conversations. But you know, the other thing that I do with that wheel is I send that to couples and I say, you know, just have fun with this. Look at it, because there's language here. If you can talk, if the neurotypical partner says, well, when I'm talking about frustrated, here's what I mean by that. I'm talking about this kind of discomfort, and this is kind of what it looks like when I'm frustrated. You know, she can actually mimic the body posture. It's different from anger. Facial expression's different, right, from anger.
Right.
So she can mimic that, and the other partner, the autistic partner, can learn that. But one of the, so that that's part of it, is just to expand that language from that inner circle into a less umbrella-like term,
yeah,
something more specific. But the other thing is to remember that for the autistic partner, because of the structure of the brain differences, the processing speed time is different for these two brains. An autistic adult who's gone his or her entire life without a diagnosis has developed, again, the experience that some will tell you, I don't even have emotions. Well, that clearly isn't true. The research and any personal work will show you that that's not true.
Right.
But what is true is that over their lifetimes, they haven't had the opportunity to have the time to recognize what their emotion actually is in any moment, call it to language, name it, and then say it, because that takes time. That's a progression that most neurotypical individuals are able to do intuitively, where the feeling is that there isn't time involved in doing it. It just is. So that I like to encourage couples to allow for that time, that processing time difference, right? Which means for the neurotypical partner, say something and give it a minute. Give it some time.
Mm-hmm.
Let your partner know that you know that it's okay to take time without being afraid or fearful of judgment or criticism, that you're willing to accommodate. That's what I mean by accommodate. Accommodate, yeah, the fact that your partner needs more time to do this than you do.
Right. However, and this is, I mean, again, just so powerful, Sarah. However, when you've been in that relationship for, again, in my case, 29 years, and you didn't know you were a neurodiverse couple, I remember, and, you know, I can vividly remember many times saying something emotional to my ex-husband or sharing an emotion and the deer in headlights look from him. And then me getting angry because there was no response.
Mm-hmm.
I am so thankful for all that I've learned, because every relationship I've had since my divorce has been with a neurodivergent man. Most of them have been autistic. And so what I will do is I will send a text, maybe to follow up after I've planted the seed about something, or the initial conversation might be a text or even an email. And I know that my processing speed is, you know, seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner's processing speed might be days or even weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not personal. And yep. I had to learn that, right? It's not personal. It's mm-hmm. that we have very different brains and very different processing speeds. And if we push our partners,
mm-hmm.
that's where we get into the conflict.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I think you've learned some very important points. One is to just the value of communicating with the written word that then removes all that nonverbal confusion.
Right.
Right, when you have a text or an email. But yes, the speed processing can take a minute, it can take a day, a week, it can take a very long time. And what I encourage the autistic partners to say is, okay, give me a minute. I don't know right now. Can I tell you later?
Oof, okay, that's a big one, Sarah. And I need for the listeners to hear that when your partner says that, you absolutely have to listen and give them that space. Because again, Sarah, here was Mona wanting a resolution, wanting that input, not getting it. And those would turn into hours of conflict and Mona crying and Mona screaming and nothing getting resolved. So please, neurotypical, holistic partners, hear that when your partner says, I don't know, or I can't continue this conversation anymore, it's time to give them space and slow down.
Yeah, I agree. And when, for two reasons, one is the one that you've just described, which is, I don't know, is a statement of fact. It's not a throwaway. It's a statement of fact. And the other one is that if you continue by thinking, as most neurotypical people do, well, I'll just say it a different way and he'll get it.
Right.
A different way. Or I'll add something, you know, I'll just give him more context. Well, then the anxiety of the autistic partner rises to complete, you know, some people call it flooding, some people call it whiteout, but it's a state of anxiety that absolutely demands a solitary time for reset. And so that's when you get the talk about the deer in the headlights. That's where you get the, well, I'm going upstairs now, while the autistic, while the neurotypical partner is still trying to contextualize her feelings in frustration. And that does not help. So when a couple gets to that, when the autistic partner says, I can't do this right now, what he can or she can also say is, I can't do this right now. I see it's important. I want to talk about it again. Can we talk about it tomorrow morning?
Yeah.
Right. In other words, close the parentheses. Right. Make sure that the non-autistic partner understands, yep, you're in a different emotional state than I am. What you're talking about is important. We will have this conversation again. Mm. And then you can do that even the next morning if you might have to go another round and then another round, as long as it's respectful of the differences in the processing.
Yeah.
You have a good chance of getting to some kind of resolution.
Yeah, I think that could make all the difference in the world. And one of the things that I recommend to couples that are very visual, where one partner is very visual, I've said, you know, write it on an index card, write it on a large post-it, and have it available so that when you literally can't find the words because you are so dysregulated, you're on the verge of a shutdown, or you're on the verge of a meltdown and about to scream out some really nasty things or throw something, that you have that post-it, you show it, and you've agreed before you've gotten into that conflict or dysregulated state that when one of you raises that or shows that, that's a stopping point. That's a complete stop, right?
I agree with you. And in fact, I actually have worked with couples to create even what you might call a safe word or a hand gesture or something to indicate, I'm at the point where this can't go on. Right. It's not your fault and it's not mine.
Right. Oh, I love that. It isn't anybody's fault. When your nervous system is dysregulated, it is time to take a complete stop. And you use the term the tragic dance. Is this when we were when we first met? Is this what you call the tragic dance, where these things keep occurring, or is it something different?
It's a term I use to describe the relationship in which there is the love that you talked about earlier. Right? The love is there. Both partners love each other. And they're in movement trying to connect. And they keep trying and trying and trying. And it keeps not working. Very confusing state. But the love holds the relationship together. And then there's this friction. So it's not... So I call it the tragic dance. It's tragic.
It is
when there isn't a viable intervention that can break some of the chains of habit that cause that ongoing friction.
I think it's so tragic. I've I've had people ask me, you know, if you and your ex-husband had known you were a neurodiverse couple, do you think you would have gotten divorced? I don't know. You know, if we had known from day one, maybe not. And maybe we would never even have gotten married because we would have realized there were so many, you know, differences that we had. I don't know. There's no way to predict the past or to change the past.
Right? You're absolutely right. And I appreciate the fact that you didn't automatically say, oh, no, we would never have got divorced. If we knew then what we know now, we would never have got that, because that's really aspirational.
Yeah.
The fact is, when couples and I work together, we get to this point. This is another turning point in our work together, which is, okay, now you know what can change and what can't. Now you've been using these tools that we've been introducing. Now you're pretty sure about what you can live with, right? Because you're cutting each other's slack. You're learning new ways to ask questions about, if I did that, what it would mean this. If you do it, what does it mean? We spent a lot of time on that one. But the other part of it is, besides what can you live with, which is the realm of change, and this is where the tragic dance notion comes up again, is the very real question of what can't you live without?
Right.
Right. And part of this work is recognizing, well, where are the parts that can't change and what do they mean to me? How important are they to me? Who am I with those needs unmet? So there's a lot of personal work involved too in this couple work. So that's why I thought your answer to that question was so profound, because you don't know what it would have felt like to be Mona knowing what you know now then. You don't know what it would have felt like.
No, I have no idea. But, you know, it helps me be a better partner in every other relationship that I've had since. I mean, even if I weren't in a neurodiverse relationship, I am a better partner. I'm a better friend. I'm a better mother. I am just a better person. So I'm very thankful for the 32 years I was with my ex-husband. And I think that's sometimes hard for people to hear and understand, because I share so honestly and openly about our challenges. But I have so many things that I am grateful for. And I've told him many, many times. And I think when couples can look through a different lens at the history that they have and focus on more of the things they're thankful for and what brought them together, that it does allow them to shift from being in that tragic dance to that, you know, focusing on that Zen beginner's mind. But again, my ex said, I don't have any more bandwidth. I got nothing left for you, Mona.
That's
and
right.
Of course,
yeah.
At the time I was destroyed, but I get it now. So, you know, that's okay too. So, Sarah, I want to go back to one thing that we talked about at the beginning about how when the couples come in, oftentimes the neurotypical or holistic partner will say, I'm so lonely. Mm-hmm. And we've gone in great detail about the tragic dance, the communication challenges, and all of that. And some of what you have shared may help the neurotypical or holistic partner understand why they're so lonely, but wanting to be less lonely and figuring out the ways to make that happen in the relationship does require a shift. Again, everything requires a shift. So is there something in particular that you share with the couple to help reduce the loneliness?
That is, that's in the side of the equation of the what can't you live without piece. Because with all the work that we can do, there's always going to be that difference between the intuitive and the non-intuitive emotional connections.
Yeah.
Right? Where for the autistic partner, it's a cognitive processing, even of emotions. And then for the neurotypical partner, it's a more intuitive framework. And, you know, when we're under pressure of any kind, whether from an external force or in an internally driven anxiety, we all do what biologists call revert to type. We all revert to type, which means that the autistic person under under duress becomes more expressively autistic, and the neurotypical partner becomes more expressively neurotypical.
Yep.
I expect everybody to just get it. I expect when I talk to my girlfriend, they just get it. I can see it and they feel it and they get it.
Right.
And I feel heard and seen. And so when the distress becomes greater in the relationship, the need actually feels heightened.
Right.
It's so frustrating. It can feel so frustrating. So two things. One, I do recommend individual work for a couple when they've been together for a long time and we do this work together. I always recommend individual work for both partners with skilled therapists who understand the neurodiverse relationship.
Amen, Sarah. Do not go to a therapist who doesn't understand neurodiverse relationships, even if you're going for individual therapy.
Exactly, particularly almost because that's where your therapist is not getting a firsthand experience of your partner and is even more likely to misread what it is you're presenting.
Yeah, and tell you to leave them and, you know, you're in a, you know, a dysfunctional relationship that's never going to change. Yeah, and that's not true. Right.
And the person you go in for individual work and your therapist says that, you know, it's not true. You know, it's not landing. Right. It's like you don't get it. But a lot of people are still intimidated by therapists and they still think, well, the therapist said that, you know, and he knows what he's talking about or she knows what she's talking about. Well, a therapist only knows what she's talking about if she's talking about something she knows about.
Right.
So that's where this risk comes in. And I always recommend that individuals make sure that there is that understanding of the neurodiverse couple, not just of autism or not, you know, for the same reason. So that's extremely important. But yeah, the individual work is where that person, that only person, can learn individual strategies for getting those needs met elsewhere. Right. Oftentimes that's in friendships or altruistic volunteer work. And when couples agree, and we haven't gotten anywhere near sex today talking about that, but oftentimes that involves a third party involved in the relationship. That can involve an affair. If that's the moral code in the situation is an agreement between two couples. So there's a lot of possibility here. It's not just, okay, I'm going to be lonely till I die. Right. There's a lot of, and also the older you get and the more generative you might feel in your field of expertise or some talent you have that you like to share with others. There's a lot of ways to get that touched in your heart. Painters can tutor kids. There's a lot of room for having a generative experience as we get older, where what we give comes back to us.
Right. And it may be that, and I've realized that as I approach 60 in a few months, I've realized that the way I define a healthy relationship has changed since I was 21, right? Sure. You know, when I met my ex-husband. And yes, we spent 32 years together. So a lot of my thinking was based on that relationship. But in the last 5-6 years, I have changed a lot, and my view of relationships has changed a lot. So, you know, if companionship is the most important thing to you, you know, making sure that you have date nights or you eat a meal or two together or you go on walks together. And if, again, not enough of your needs are met in the relationship, and they are things that you want in a relationship, it's data, it's information for you each to process and decide, is this still the relationship I want to be in? Yeah, that's so, so important. So I want to touch on one more subject and then we can close out. But I know a lot of times I hear from the neurotypical holistic person that their partner always starts with a no. The response is a no.
Yeah.
And I understand why now, but I'd love if you could share, because this was the case in my marriage too.
Sure.
So if you could share a little bit of like your understanding around that, and we can get a little bit of clarity on that. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to share that too.
Sure. That does come up all the time. And I always like to talk about it in terms of the autistic state. because one of the challenges with autism is because it's a schematic kind of structural cognitive approach to receiving information and acting in the world. It's very important to the person to understand, well, this is how this is, and this is how this is. This is what this thing does. This is what I do when I go here. All those things are extremely important. Some people call them Rubik's. Some of my clients call them rules. But what's important for the non-autistic part to understand is that anything that you say is very likely to bump into a rule. Mm. And it's like pulling a pillar out of a four-pillared edifice. It's very destabilizing immediately, and it feels like confusion. It's very, very difficult. It's what you hear when you hear that autistic individuals are change averse. This is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
and that's because when you are making any statement that bumps into one of those rules, you're requesting change. You're making a demand. And the neurotypical partner say, well, I'm not making a demand. I'm saying, what would you like for lunch?
Right.
That's not a demand. Well, it's a demand in this sense. Your autistic partner is thinking about something else, is working on his computer. She's reading a book. You ask that question. Well, you're asking that person to stop doing what they're doing, pay attention to what you're doing, and come and answer a question they hadn't anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of complexity. So no is the way to make that person feel stable.
Yeah.
It's fact averse. I mean, it's fact free. It's just a way of stabilizing an emotional state. So what do you do when you get that? You have a conversation about, one thing for the non-autistic partner to remember is, pick your time.
Right.
Right. If your partner is doing something or not doing something, that partner is doing something else other than what you're going to be bringing in. So what you can say is, may I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is a kind of a neutral, it is an interruption. It will still feel a little destabilizing, but there's no emotional spin on it. It's a very neutral question. And then that partner has a chance to say, I'm doing this right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the way you explained it is going to be, you know, so helpful to both partners, because, you know, sometimes we do things that have become habits and we can't even explain to our partner why we do it. I mean, I remember my ex coming home from work every night and literally eating the same thing every mm-hmm. night.
Sure. Yeah,
right. Because, and I had made a nice dinner, and for me, sitting down and having a meal and processing our days was a form of connection that mm-hmm. I desperately needed. So when that happened, I took it personally. I felt that I wasn't valued in the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. All those things.
Yeah.
Because I was reading it through my neurotypical or holistic lens and right. not through my ex's lens. And so now all that makes so much sense. And we've talked about on the podcast how important having time for transition mm-hmm. is. And when we don't, again, when we don't give our partner grace, when we don't accommodate each other's needs to create a more balanced relationship, then we've got the conflict. Then we've got, you know, that wasn't my intent, but it hit really hard. And then it turns into a fighting, you know, match or whatever. So that is really, really, really important and really, really helpful. And, you know, I remember my ex saying to me at the end of our marriage, I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast. He said, and it was in a text, I think, I don't think it was in a conversation. He said, you know, at the end of our relationship, I get to the point where the easiest response for me was no.
Mm-hmm.
But he used to say no, or he used to just shut down. He used to just mm-hmm. be quiet and not respond. And yeah. he said, because I didn't have any more bandwidth to deal with whatever yeah. you were putting out to me. Mm-hmm. And I get it, because if you were experiencing what Mona was kind of putting out there on the table for 30 years, and you didn't necessarily know what you needed, that you needed time, that you needed things to slow down, that you needed transition periods. Of course, that's exhausting.
Yeah.
Of course, it's overwhelming. Of course, you're going to say no to protect your own emotional space.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely
right.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it hurt at the time. And I know there are so many other couples that are hurting. So everything that you shared, Sarah, will hopefully be the beginning of maybe some real positive changes in more neurodiverse relationships. And I am so excited, Sarah, because Sarah and I are going to be doing a workshop on Zoom. It's going to be $25. It's going to be on September 13th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I will post this on Instagram, on the Neurodiverse Love Instagram account. And I will, if you're subscribing to my newsletter, I will be sending this out this week. If you are interested in joining us, we would love to have you. And we're going to focus on two main questions, but we're going to address, you know, whatever the folks who are in attendance would like us to address. It's going to be a 90-minute, it possibly will go a little bit longer than that, 90-minute workshop. And so the two main questions we're going to address is, what can you live with, right? And what can't you live with, or what can't you live without? And so we're going to be going much more in depth into all of this, taking your questions, having some great discussions. And I hope that a lot of you will be able to join us. And if that time doesn't work, we are thinking about recording the workshop so that we can send it to those people who can't attend live. Do you want to add anything to that?
Other than that, I look forward to it. I think it's going to be a wonderful opportunity for all of us to talk together and address the things that come up that are important to everyone in the context of what Mona just described, but also anything else. And I truly do look forward to it.
Yeah, me too. It's going to be phenomenal. And so, Sarah, I can't thank you enough for enlightening the audience, for sharing things in such simple terms that I think will be so helpful to a lot of folks out there. And I know that there are going to be a lot of folks that want to reach out to you, that want to contact you. So what is the best place for folks to find you, Sarah?
The best place, and thank you, by the way, Mona, it's a real pleasure to be here today to speak with you and your group, your audience. Because I am unfortunately not able to work with all the couples who do contact me directly, in a perfect world, I could. But what I've created is a Substack, and I don't know whether your listeners are familiar with that, but you can find me at sarahswensonlmhc.substack.com. And there you'll find an ability, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, which is content rich with tips and all kinds of recommendations, as well as full articles. There's a podcast, which I also do. My podcast is available there. You can also sign up for a 30-minute consultation that way. And that way we can talk about one challenge or issue you'd like to talk about in 30 minutes. It's not counseling, obviously, but it can certainly answer any nagging question you may have. But it's an ongoing series of information I'd like to be able to spread widely with as many individuals and couples as possible.
I think that's wonderful. Yeah. And this is, thank you so much for that, Sarah, because there are so many skilled professionals who are either therapists or counselors or coaches who have been providing their support to neurodiverse couples throughout the world. And they're inundated. They just, they have wait lists. They can't take any more clients. And so the fact that you have this available for folks that are looking for more information and, you know, to educate themselves in ways that they might not have been able to in the past, that is fantastic. So that will go in the show notes. So we are at the end of the podcast, and I would love to know if there's something else that you want to share with the listeners, if there's words of wisdom or, you know, something that you want to hone in on that we didn't address or that you want to reiterate. How would you like to send the listeners your parting words? What would you like to say?
Well, first of all, I want to express my gratitude to you for including me today. I have great admiration for your work and the information and resources you provide, Mona.
Oh, thank you.
Secondly, I would really like to encourage any neurodiverse couple who may have had the experience of giving up with a therapist or a counselor to look at the resources that Mona is offering, look at some of my resources, and remember that there's always a little wiggle room. There's always things that can change that might give you a slightly different perspective on your relationship and might give you a chance for having some of the things that you need that you're not getting. And that includes both of you.
Yeah. Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful way to end the podcast. And I always tell folks, your relationship is not a community project. It's not a family project. It's not a work project. It's not a church or a synagogue project. Whatever works for the two of you is what works.
I agree.
Yeah, you don't have to meet the world's expectations. So, you know, I know couples who live in different states. I know couples who live next door in different duplexes. I know couples who live in different cities. You know, whatever works, or, you know, a basement apartment and an upstairs apartment, doesn't matter. Whatever works. People are going to judge you no matter what. So make your relationship work with whatever unique changes you need to make. Sarah, it's been an absolute joy, an absolute pleasure. I look forward to our workshop on Zoom on September 13th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we look forward to seeing many of you there for the workshop. And if anybody has any questions or needs any additional information, you can email me at neurodiverselove, the number 4, the letter U, at gmail.com. And I'll put that in the show notes. Thank you again, Sarah, for everything that you are doing to help neurodiverse couples throughout the world. I really appreciate it. And I'm so glad we had an opportunity to talk.
Likewise. Thank you, Mona.
Take care.